From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Waiting Men by Penelope Wallace. I first met John Holfax when we were both up at Oxford. I wasn't a close friend of his. He didn't have any. His mother was an American from the Middle West. His father was English. They were both dead. John was quiet and reserved and brilliant, and he always gave me a strong sense of destiny or predestiny. His first in English took him to a Scottish university, and then I lost touch with him. I'd heard that he had gone abroad. It was about 5 years later that I saw him again. It was in London. He was coming out of a bookshop near the British Museum, clasping a brown paper parcel. He looked older, but I recognized him instantly. "John," I called from across the street. "John Holfax." He turned, and his face had the look of ecstasy that a saint might wear after his first vision. As he saw me, the expression disappeared behind a fleeting curtain of suspicion. Then he recognized me, and I was delighted to see genuine pleasure. He crossed the road in the June sunshine with his usual disinterest, impossible traffic, and shook me warmly by the hand. "What a coincidence," he said. "I was just thinking you might be one of the few people who would appreciate this," and he tapped the parcel reverently. I have never been a literary type. "What is it, a first folio?" I asked, hoping it wasn't repaying flattery with ignorance. "It isn't a book," he replied. "It's a painting, and it's absolute." It was a favorite word of his. "May I look?" "Yes, but not now. I'm going to take it home and hang it." He paused as an unintentional pun. "I know just where it's going. Do you know, the moment I saw it, I knew it was for me, and I knew just where it was destined to go." His visionary expression returned, and I was afraid that he was going to depart without telling me where home might be. "Where are you living?" I asked. "What? Oh, yes. It's rather a small bedsitter quite near here. 15 Tavistock Row. It's somewhat sordid house, but I'm at the top, and the view is absolute. I'm writing now, you know." I wasn't clear whether his occupation explained the view or the sordidness, or both, but I took out my diary and wrote down his address. "Make it tomorrow, about 8. That gives me time to know it completely before you see it." I didn't really follow, but I said I'd be there the following evening, and we parted. In fact, I looked forward to my visit. I suffered, as one does in the London race, from acute if sporadic nostalgia for the Oxford life. The time to talk, the chip cups of Nescafe, and I wondered about his painting. My own taste is conservative. Would it be some delicate Madonna? I tried to visualize the print in his rooms at Oxford. I seemed to remember Dutch interiors, which I have always thought to be somewhat dull and static. Whatever his new find proved to be, I hoped that it would be as dramatic as John had led me to expect. It was. I climbed the long flight of stairs, assailed by the faint odors of cabbage and gas, inescapable in that type of establishment. I thought that I had reached the top when I saw a half-open door, but the good-looking redhead inside pointed to a further flight of stairs, invisible from where I stood. The name pinned by the door read, "Marjorie Singleton." I thanked her and went on up. There were two doors. The one on the left was bolted on the outside, so I knocked on the other. The door opened about 6 inches, and John Holfax said, "You've got to see her properly. Shut your eyes." This childlike exuberance was quite unlike the man I had known, but I obediently closed my eyes and allowed myself to be led into the room. The evening sun was warm on my face. He swung me completely round and said, almost in a whisper, "Now, open your eyes." I opened my eyes. The sun over my shoulder lit up the picture, and I could think of nothing to say. It was the most horrifying thing I had ever seen. Not obscene or sensational, just paralyzingly horrifying, so for a moment I could not even take it in the details. The picture was about 10 inches by 12, and it had a look of evening. Mountains in the distance seemed to catch the dying rays of the sun. There was a tree in the foreground, but it wasn't a landscape. Over a branch of the tree hung a noosed rope, and two men stood, one on each side, waiting. They were Stetsons, and you might think it was a prelude to a lynching from a cowboy film, except for the absence of the victim and for the overpowering evilness of the two men. It was not only in their faces, although they were bad enough, it pervaded their bodies, the seemingly casual, vicious alertness. They stood well apart, the noose dangling above and between them. They did not look at it, but in every line of their bodies they showed their awareness and their evil waiting watchfulness. I had almost said in their every movement, for they were so powerfully vivid. I am not an emotional type, and I surprised myself as much as I did John when I heard myself saying, "Burn it, John. Take it down and burn it." "Burn it," he repeated. "What are you talking about?" He seemed stunned, then, "Sit down and have a drink." I sat down, with my back to the painting, and I had my drink, and I tried to be rational, to tell myself that it was a fine painting, realistic, interesting. We talked of other things, of life at Oxford, of my job as a junior executive in industry. John told me of his life in Scotland. He was evasive about his travels after that, though he mentioned South America briefly. I was beginning to enjoy my visit when I happened to glance up and I saw that he was looking at the painting, as a man will look at the woman he loves, as a man will glimpse his destiny. And I blamed the dubious sherry I had been drinking, and I wished I were far away. As I was leaving, he said, "You've got to agree that it's powerful." "Yes," I agreed. "It is powerful." I sent him an invitation to a party I was giving where he seemed to enjoy himself. I knew that he would be witty and amusing when he wanted to be, and it looked as if he was getting over the shyness which had kept him so solitary. For a while, we saw him fairly frequently. When my wife's younger sister came to stay with us, we all went to the theater a couple of times, and he would often come in for drinks or coffee. Neither of us mentioned the picture, and he never suggested I should visit him. Looking back, it is difficult to remember when his visits became less frequent. I remember just before Christmas, thinking that he was not looking too well and blaming it on the freezing weather. It was one evening early in the new year when the telephone rang. I thought at first that was a wrong number because I didn't recognize the labored tones. "Please forgive me for bothering you," said the voice, female and elderly as far as I could judge. "It's about Mr. Holfax. I didn't like the phone from the house, so I'm calling from the station." The distant thunder of a passing train proved her statement and drowned her next words. "But he keeps all his invitations on the mantelpiece, so that's how I got your name in. I hope you'll forgive me." "Is something the matter with Mr. Holfax?" I asked. "Is he ill?" "Not exactly," she admitted. "But as I was explaining, I'm his landlady, Mrs. Brown, and I'm a bit worried about him, and knowing you were a friend of his, I thought perhaps you could come and see him and cheer him up. I hope..." "Of course I'll come," I said firmly. "I'll come around in about an hour." When I got outside, it was snowing heavily, and I wondered whether I'd promised rashly. I diverted to buy a half bottle of whiskey. It had a festive air and might save me from John's intolerable sherry. The house at Tavistock Row might have looked picturesque in the falling snow, but I didn't stop to admire it. I trudged up the steps, hoping that the street door would be latched back, as it had been on my previous visit. It wasn't the weather for waiting on doorsteps. The door swung open as I pushed it, and I stamped some of the snow from my shoes and headed for the stairs. But from the murky darkness of the hall, a large woman materialized. "I'm Mrs. Brown. I hope..." "Good evening, Mrs. Brown," I said before she could ask forgiveness yet again. "I'm just going up to see Mr. Holfax. What exactly is the matter with him?" "It's difficult to say, but I worry about him, and I worry about my other guests. Tenants, you know. They haven't actually complained. These days they don't. They just up and go. There was a nice gentleman on the floor below. He says he has to move for business reasons, but I wonder..." "What has Mr. Holfax been doing?" I asked. "I thought I'd explained. It's at night. He screams." It sounded very strange, and as I said goodnight and left Mrs. Brown as politely as I could, I wondered whether she was being imaginative or naive. I found John Holfax sitting listlessly in a chair, facing the window. He had an almost guilty expression, and for a moment I wondered whether he had taken my advice and burned the painting. I looked hopefully for the blank space in the wall, but the painting was still there. Its horror just as strong, repellent, yet compelling. I sat down carefully where I wouldn't see it and produced the whiskey. John got out glasses and poured it. He looked ill. Above all, he looked incredibly tired. "How are you?" I asked. "Fine. Do you sleep well?" He passed me a glass, well filled with whiskey, and began to drink from his own, in a detached sort of way. Finally he said, "I do not, as Mrs. Brown no doubt told you." "Damn woman," he muttered. "I do not sleep well. I dream every night, all night." His face was bitter and unhappy. "What about sleeping pills?" I asked. "I went to the doctor. I got sleeping pills. I slept, and I dreamt." "Always the same dream?" His answers were becoming litanic, and I realized that he was avoiding the cause of the dreams, refusing even to recognize it. "Have you tried a psychiatrist?" I asked. "No," he shouted and slammed his empty glass on the table. "I had to find out." "Why not?" I asked bluntly. He leaned forward in his chair. I realized that he was trying to decide how to tell me. "Because," he said, "I cannot do that to them. Once they were my friends." "What do you mean? Who were your friends?" He was silent, as though he didn't hear the question, or as if he thought that I knew the answer, and maybe I did. And then I wondered which of us, in fact, needed a psychiatrist. Soon after that, I left him. I thought about him during the days that followed. I knew that he needed help, which I couldn't give him. It was exactly a week later, at 3 a.m, that Mrs. Brown telephoned again. This time, I heard her distinctly. Presumably, she was calling from home, but I couldn't take it in at once. "Please come," she was saying. "He's gone. Mr. Holfax has gone." "Gone? Gone where?" I asked stupidly. "He's just disappeared. I've called the police because the front door was still bolted on the inside, and there were no footprints in the snow. Please come." I wonder what help I'd be if she had called the police. If they came. "You were his friend," she said, and I weakly agreed. It took me over half an hour to get dressed and find a taxi. The snow was no longer falling. It lay hard and sparkling in the moonlight. As I paid off the taxi at Tavistock Row, I saw that there were several large prints on the steps. Evidently, the police had arrived. They had come, I learned, under the misapprehension that someone had broken in rather than out. By now, they had their facts right and were interested in the mystery for its own sake. For mystery, it certainly was. The sergeant waiting in the hall asked my name, my address, my occupation, and how I came to arrive at that time in the morning. I told him. He reluctantly dismissed me as a suspect, took me into Mrs. Brown's sitting room, and told me what had happened. It appeared Mrs. Brown insisted that her tenants be in before midnight. At this hour, she bolted and chained the front door. Marjorie Singleton on the floor below had admitted that she often heard screams from John Holfax's room. It was over her own, but, as she confessed to the sergeant, she hadn't minded particularly as she hadn't been alone at the time. Swearing the sergeant's secrecy, which he was happily breaking by telling me, she had admitted that her companion had been Robert Jarvis, Brown floored back, and that on the previous night the gallant Mr. Jarvis had offered to mend Mrs. Brown's television set. This had taken longer than he had estimated, and the patient Marjorie had waited in a room with the door slightly open. The other room on the floor was vacant. As she kept her vigil, Marjorie Singleton had heard, through the thin ceiling, the creak of the floorboard, the voice crying out, and footsteps, and then suddenly a terrible scream, much worse than anything she had ever heard before. She hurried to the doorway, debating her next move, and thankfully heard Robert's ascending step. He too had heard the scream, and he went up the stairs to the top floor. John Holfax's room was empty. Yet Marjorie and Robert could swear that no one had come down the stairs, and the other room on the top floor, used for storage, and the trap door were still securely bolted on the outside. They had told their story to Mrs. Brown, accounting their meeting in Marjorie's doorway to their separate concern about the scream, and Mrs. Brown had searched the rest of the house, noted the still bolted front door, opened it, and seen the unbroken snow. Then she had called the police. "And there you are," said the sergeant in proprietary tones. Perhaps you can tell me something more about this gentleman, Mr. John Holfax. I told him all I knew, which wasn't much. I didn't think he had any relations still living. It was Mrs. Brown, joining us at the stage, who mentioned the picture. She came in with welcome cups of tea and sat herself heavily on a faded chair. "Terrible thing," she said. "Not that I saw him that often, and for the past 6 months I've hardly been in his room at all, twice at the most, not since he got that horrible picture. I never looked at it closely. It gave me the creeps. Some sort of hanging it was." The sergeant admitted he hadn't noticed it. "But then," he said, "I wasn't searching for a body, alive or otherwise, not looking at pictures." We finished our tea in silence, and then, since there was nowhere else to search for John Holfax, the sergeant decided that we might as well look at the painting, and we all trooped up the stairs. I was the first to enter the room. I switched on a light. The bed was in front of us, sheets and blankets trailing on the floor. I turned to the painting and I stood, unable to speak or move. The horror. The implications were unbearable, for the noose no longer hung limp from the tree. The rope was strained and taut from the weight of the man who hung there, and that man was John Holfax. I must have said something, for Mrs. Brown, the sergeant, stepped forward to examine the painting. "It's quite true," said Mrs. Brown. "I'd never looked before, but that man does look like Mr. Holfax." "Ah," said the sergeant, "likely that's why he bought the picture." I tried to tell them that the noose had been empty, and I could see from their sympathetic glances that it was useless, and I might have wondered myself. Only there was something else. No longer were the men in the painting waiting, watchful. They were evil, but they were relaxed. They had fulfilled their destiny. And the hanging man, had he fulfilled his? The Tibetan Box by Elizabeth Walter. It was during tea that the Tibetan box was first mentioned. As soon as she noticed it, incongruously perched on the rosewood work table in the window, Alice Norrington wondered how she could possibly have overlooked it till then. In the same instant she asked, in her most authoritarian manner, "Mary, where did you get that box?" From her sofa, Mary Norrington followed the direction of her sister's gaze. She was not yet used to being a semi-invalid, and the excitement of her only sister's return after a 3-year tour of duty in the mission field had tired her more than she'd wanted to admit. As if that were not enough, there was a strain of a third person's presence. She had somehow never suspected that her sister would be accompanied by her friend and colleague, Ellen Whittaker. Equally, it had obviously never occurred to Alice that Miss Whittaker was not included in the invitation. An extra room had had to be made ready as unobtrusively as possible. Mrs. Forrest, who did, had not been pleased. Moreover, since the moment of her arrival, Alice had kept up a ceaseless catechism on Mary's health, finances, future plans, and wishes. Now she has started on the box. "I bought it in a jumble sale," Mary said tiredly. "It's rather unusual, isn't it?" "It's unusual to find anything worth buying in a jumble sale," Miss Whittaker observed. Alice was already on her feet. "May I look at it?" she asked, moving briskly across the room at a rate that Mary now envied, remembering that she could have equaled it a mere 6 months ago. A moment later she was calling from the window. "I say, this is magnificent, Ellen. Come here and have a look at this." "Why don't you bring it nearer the fire?" Miss Whittaker asked placidly, continuing to sip her tea. The visit to Alice's sister was proving even more difficult than she had expected, and she had never expected very much. She had expressed her doubts about accompanying Alice, but Alice in her autocratic way had insisted that she should, and since Miss Whittaker had no friends or relatives in England, she had allowed her scruples to be overborne. Now, of course, she was regretting it. Her presence was too obviously neither anticipated nor desired. Moreover, as is often the way with sisters, Mary and Alice were too much alike to get on. The same imprudence, arrogance, and self-confidence, a strong personality, in short, were evident in both the Misses Norrington. They had never forgotten that they were the squire's daughters, and that it was for them to be liberal with advice, lofty in example, and inalienably right at all times. Alice, at least, possessed considerable administrative ability. The African mission field was pockmarked by her vigorous descent upon it, but neither sister possessed what Miss Whittaker would have described as humility. Mary, for all her weakened state, was the less humble of the two. She was sitting up now with something of her old decisive manner. It was all very well for Alice to invade her home, even though that home was no more than 4-bedroom throstle cottage when once they had been used to living at the Hall times, and servants might not be what they had been. Income remained fixed in a world where all else rose. But an Englishwoman's home was still her castle, and only one woman was in control. "Bring the box over here, Alice," she commanded, superimposing her orders on Miss Whittaker's request. "And please, draw the curtains while you're at the window. It's already beginning to get dark." She was right. The garden was filling with shadows. The trees, still in leaf, for it was only October as yet, were bowing to one another in a gentle rising wind. "This will bring the leaves down," Alice Norrington reflected. "We must sweep the garden and have a bonfire soon." As though she had communicated her thoughts in some way, Mary said, "We need another log on this fire. Alice, dear, I wonder if you would be good enough to put one on." Her sister complied with some annoyance, placing the box on her chair. Mary's severe heart attack had in no way softened that organ. She was as autocratic as she had ever been, more so in fact, for invalid state gave her certain rights and privileges which she was not slow to abuse. Nevertheless, it seemed odd and unnatural to see Mary so much shrunken and aged. Her face had a grayness, despite a discreet use of makeup. The excitement of their arrival had made her pant. The doctor said bluntly it had been touch and go with her. It was doubtful if she would ever lead a normally active life again, and the attack had come without the slightest sign or warning. Since childhood, Mary had never had a day's illness in her life. If it came to that, Alice thought, she hadn't either. The Norringtons were what one might call healthy stock. She smiled grimly and stood up, brushing her tweed skirt as she did so. Ellen Whittaker had picked up the box. It was on her lap, and from where she stood, Alice could see it clearly. It reaffirmed her impression that it was a magnificent piece of work, made of some unknown dark hardwood, its carvings burnished by age and care to a subtle sheen. It measured some 13 by 9 by 3¾ inches. It was fitted with a hinged lid and a lock. The key was missing, but this could hardly count as a defect, and the lid and sides of the box were so ornately and intricately carved that it would have been well worth snapping up at a jumble sale, even if it had been in far worse condition. But whoever would give a box like that to a jumble sale? "Major Murphy," Mary said when asked, adding, "I don't think you would know him, Alice. They only came here since you were last home on leave. They took the Red House on a 7-year renewable tenancy. We all liked them so much. Stella Murphy was a great gardener. She had the garden looking lovely. Such a pity the new people have let it go." "New people? Didn't the Murphys finish their tenancy?" "My dear, the most dreadful thing. Stella died." "Good gracious," Alice exclaimed. "How tragic." Tragic it certainly was. She jabbed the fork into her finger while bedding out some rock plants. "Such a little cut it was. I saw it. Within 48 hours she was dead. Tetanus. I never heard anything so dreadful." Alice duly echoed her sister, but Ellen Whittaker, who had seen and heard many dreadful things, did not. Instead, she asked, examining the box intently, "Did the Major tell you where this came from?" "I don't think he knew," Mary said. "It actually belonged to Stella. I thought it rather unfeeling, putting something of hers in the sale. But perhaps he only wanted to help the church. He was leaving the district, and it was such an obvious snip. I asked him what he estimated was worth, and he said he thought a pound would be plenty. So I put in 30 shillings and took it home myself. I never thought to ask him where it came from, but it looks Chinese to me." Miss Whittaker shook her head decidedly. "It's not Chinese. I can tell you that for sure. I'd say it was Tibetan." The sisters looked at her inquiringly. "Ellen, how do you know?" Alice asked. "I was in India before I came to Africa," Miss Whittaker answered. "I spent some time in Nepal. It's on the Tibetan border. I've seen a good deal of Tibetan work." "If you can read their writing," Mary suggested, "there's an inscription underneath that might help. I asked Major Murphy about it, and he said he didn't know what it meant. I'm sure he was lying. Somehow, it's probably something not quite nice." "The carvings don't look particularly erotic," Alice observed with interest. "Offhand, I'd have said they were threatening in some way. The adjective was a disturbingly apt one. The surface of the lid was filled by a rampant dragon, his face surrounded by a curious beard or frill. His eyes must have originally been jewels, but now only empty sockets remained. From these flared two long whiskers like a mandarin's mustache. Face and body were covered with fish-like scales, and a ridge of spines ran down the center of the back. One forefoot was raised as if to lash out, and every foot had four wicked-looking claws. The body writhed and coiled in undulation, this way and that across the lid. The tail, with a final upward flick toward the vertical, was finished with a vicious little barb. Around the sides of the box were lesser dragons, carved in profile but equally aroused. Two dragons faced each other on the long side. On the short, a single dragon glared outward at the world. "There seems no reason why the Major shouldn't have translated the inscription," Alice continued. "Do you think he knew what it said?" "He very well may have done. I understand he was in the Indian Army."
"And how long ago did this all take place?" Alice questioned.
"It's 7 months today since I bought the box," Mary said. Seeing her sister look startled, she elaborated. "The jumble sale was on a Saturday. Contributions were brought in on Thursday to leave us Friday for marking and pricing the stuff. So I bought the box on a Thursday, and 3 weeks later, I had my heart attack. I remember when that was without trying, so that it makes it 7 months to the day. It's a pity there wasn't a longer interval," she added. "I was going to have the dragon's missing eye restored. I thought rubies, perhaps, very small and deep and glowing." She was interrupted by a cry from Ellen Whittaker, who was gazing intently at the underside of the box.
"What is it?" Alice asked.
"A protruding nail?"
"No, oh no, it's nothing like that. It's this inscription."
"Do you mean to say you can read it?"
"I'm afraid I can." Mary clapped her hands in childlike triumph. "I'm so glad. I've been longing to know what it says."
"You won't be so glad when you hear it. Is it really something obscene?"
"I wish it were," Ellen Whittaker said grimly. She put the box on the floor and drew imperceptibly away.
"It's Tibetan, all right," she informed them. "A Tibetan magician's box. In it would have been kept all the tools of his art or profession, closely guarded from curious eyes."
"A sort of conjurer's box?" Alice suggested.
"No, something more sinister than that. There is no accounting for the power of these magicians. No rational explanation will suffice. They can bless or curse with equal efficaciousness, and the inscription on the box is a curse."
"What a terrible hold superstition has on these people." Alice Norrington was already planning a crusade.
"Miss Whittaker," answered her sharply,
"superstition's hardly the word. You don't have to believe in their magic to be affected."
"Even in England?" Mary inquired.
Miss Whittaker did not trouble to answer. She had seen Tibetan magic at work, but the Mrs. Norrington, younger and less experienced, were clamorous to know details.
"Why the curse?" Alice Norrington demanded.
"In case the box was stolen," her friend replied. "The magician's is a hereditary calling. The box would be handed down from father to son. It could only fall into unauthorized hands because it was stolen, in the first instance at any rate. Hence the curse on all those who possess it. They have no right to it, you see."
"I like that," Mary Norrington exclaimed angrily. "I paid a perfectly fair price for that box." Her anger was the greater because it was not strictly ethical to buy items before the jumble sale had started. She remembered Major Murphy had looked at her oddly at the time.
"There was nothing dishonest about my acquiring it," she said defensively.
"How did Major Murphy get a hold of it, do you know?"
"I told you it belonged to Stella."
"The woman who died of tetanus?"
"Oh, yes."
Miss Whittaker stood up abruptly, clasping her hands behind her, feet astride. She looked oddly out of place among the chintz and afternoon tea things of Throstle Cottage. Too gaunt, too sallow, too much an archetype.
"Mary," she announced, putting all the urgency into her words of which she was capable.
"You must get rid of that accursed box."
"Certainly not. It's one of my favorite possessions."
"If you don't, you'll be dead in 6 months."
"Whatever are you talking about, Ellen? What has the box to do with me?
Merely that it promises death within a 12-month to all unlawful possessors. You've already had half your time.
There was a moment's horrified silence. Then Mary Norrington gave a shaky laugh.
You're not going to tell me you believe this nonsense, Ellen. You, a worker in the Christian mission field?
Christianity has nothing to do with it, Miss Whittaker answered firmly. These magicians have a curious control over natural forces, to which the human body is as much subject as anything else. I needn't point out the coincidence of your having a heart attack 3 weeks after you first acquired the box.
I beg you to get rid of it before further mischief comes upon you, as most assuredly it will.
Her sincerity was so obvious that Mary Norrington began to hesitate. The heart attack that had so surely reduced her had come like a bolt from the blue. There was no history of cardiac disorder in her family, and she herself had seemed as strong as an ox. Her doctor had been quite unable to account for it, although he assured her there was nothing unique about her case. What was even more disturbing was her failure to make a good recovery. 6 months later, she was still as weak as a kitten, and this had been preying on her mind. Nonetheless, she had no intention of yielding to Ellen Whittaker's superstition. Such a show of respect for heathen practice should receive no condemnation from her.
I hardly see how I can give the box away, she said sweetly, now that you have acquainted me with the nature of the curse. It would be tantamount, surely, to murder. I do not think I could bring myself to commit that.
The best thing would be to return it to Tibet, Miss Whittaker suggested, in hope that it falls into good hands.
There might be difficulties with a customs declaration. Besides, can one send things to Tibet?
I have a friend in India who might help us.
Why go to so much trouble? Alice Norrington asked. She had been listening uneasily to the argument, which affected her own divided state of mind. On the one hand, her faith and reason were against it. On the other was the fact that Mary was ill, and there was not only Mary, but also the previous owner, the late Mrs. Murphy. Of course, both could be coincidence merely. All the same, it was unpleasantly odd. But Alice's was a direct, uncomplicated nature. The devious was foreign to her mind, and she was accustomed to going to the root of any problem, and her solutions were effective, if extreme.
Why bother to return the box to Tibet? She repeated. Why not simply destroy it here and now?
Mary smiled at her with sisterly approval.
An excellent notion, my dear.
With Alice, thought was quickly succeeded by action. If you have no objection, I will attend to it straight away. There is no doubt a hatchet in the cellar. I will chop it up for firewood at once.
I wouldn't, if I were you, Alice. Miss Whittaker had gone very pale. Both sisters regarded her in amazement.
Ellen, what is it? Are you ill?
No, but you must not touch that box. It is dangerous.
I must ask you to explain yourself.
There's another line in the inscription, Miss Whittaker whispered. It promises destruction to anyone attempting to destroy it.
So one can neither keep the box nor destroy it.
What can one do with it, may I ask?
Miss Whittaker shook her head helplessly.
You can only send it back.
Nonsense, Ellen. Alice Norrington spoke very firmly. You must not allow these superstitious thoughts to get a hold. You will soon be little better than the heathen you are supposed to be converting.
This error must be rooted out at once. I shall go to the cellar now and dispose of this ridiculous Tibetan magic box forever.
No, as her friend put out a restraining hand. Don't try to stop me. I have quite made up my mind.
You will regret it, Ellen Whittaker murmured. You will regret it all your life, or what is left.
Alice Norrington did not bother to answer, and a moment later they heard her going down the cellar stairs. The cellar was directly under the sitting room, and they could hear her moving about, shifting the chopping block into position, and then a clatter as she dropped the axe. Mary Norrington jumped as though the blade had bitten into her, but Miss Whittaker showed all the calmness of despair. A moment later they heard the first ringing blow of the hatchet, and perceptibly they both relaxed.
When one is ill, Mary said apologetically, one so easily becomes overwrought.
When one has spent long years on the Tibetan border, Miss Whittaker responded bravely.
one forgets that in England its standards do not apply. Before she had finished speaking, both women were paralyzed by a hoarse and terrible cry. It rose out of the depths of the cellarage beneath them, an animal cry of anguish and pain and fear. The voice was recognizably Alice Norrington's. A moment later, they heard her stumbling up the stairs. Both listeners were on their feet in an instant, but Miss Whittaker was first through the door. The cellar door opened into the hall of the Throstle cottage. Alice Norrington had almost reached the top of the cellar stairs. She had been silent since the first inexplicable scream of terror, but they could hear the rasping of her breath. Mary was leaning, white-faced, upon the hall table. It fell to Miss Whittaker to move towards the cellar door. She was halfway across the hall when Alice entered. Her features were still rigid from the shock she had undergone. Blood was spurting from a hand on which three fingers were now missing. Her protruding eyes were fixed unseeingly in space. Mary hid her face in her hands with a little cry of horror, but it was not the first time Ellen Whittaker had faced emergency. She had seen violent death and bodies torn and broken, and her common sense and energy, as usual, did not fail to respond. Almost before her senses had recovered, her brain was active, propelling her body forwards, uttering commands. "It's all right, Alice. Don't be frightened, Mary. The doctor, quick! No, give me the table napkins before you telephone. You must put a tourniquet on at once. Keep your head down, Alice. It may help you to feel better. I promise you, we'll not let you die of this." Half carrying, half dragging, she got the fainting Alice to a chair. Mary was already dialing the doctor's number as she applied pressure to the artery in the wrist. To her relief, the blood spurt slackened and slowed to nothing, although the blood continued to well out copiously. Alice moaned and stirred and endeavored to sit upright. "It's all right," Miss Whittaker reassured her. "It's better you shouldn't look." Alice took no notice of the injunction. Her eyes were still staring and wild. From the sitting room, Mary's voice on the telephone came faintly. "My sister, an accident. Come at once." Suddenly, Alice gripped her friend's arm with unexpected intensity. Her fingertips were cold on Miss Whittaker's flesh. "It was the box," she whispered hoarsely. "It moved as I was about to strike it and dragged my fingers under the axe. Otherwise, it would never have happened. But the box moved, and I couldn't stop it. I tell you, Ellen, the Tibetan box moved." While Alice Norrington was in hospital, Miss Whittaker remained at Throstle Cottage in a position which he rapidly recognized as that of unpaid companion drudge. There was no doubt that Mary Norrington had been shaken by her sister's accident. There was equally no doubt that with her heart condition, shock and distress were liable to bring on another attack, which attack might possibly prove fatal. But this was problematical. Miss Whittaker could not feel that it warranted the day-in, day-out attendance she was obviously expected to provide. By the end of the first week, she had enough not only of Mary's tyranny, but of Mary's patronage, which was worse. It began with Miss Whittaker's appearance. Mary had no scruples about making personal remarks. Indeed, it amused Miss Whittaker to note the resemblance between the sisters, except that whereas Alice spent her energies in the mission field, Mary Norrington pursued lesser ends near home. But she adopted the same bludgeoning tactics as her sister, with possibly comparable results. For while there was no doubt that Alice was effective in securing conversions, Miss Whittaker wondered to what extent they represented change of heart. She was half amused, half horrified, to find herself giving way to Mary, putting cold cream on her face for the first time in 20 years, and treating her dry hair to an oil bath before a special shampoo. She consoled herself that she was doing it for Alice, but she was too honest to accept such glazing for long. She was doing it for the sake of peace and quietness. Alice's converts presumably did the same. The thought of Alice as a colleague brought back to her the tragic aspect of the affair, for with her maimed hand it seemed unlikely that Alice would ever be past fit for service in the mission field again. Moreover, her nervous system had suffered a severe shock, and the tense, fevered woman, who laid her sound hand like a claw on Miss Whittaker's arm whenever they were alone together, and besought her to get rid of the Tibetan box, was someone very different from the active, no-nonsense colleague whom Ellen Whittaker had always known. By common consent, they did not mention the matter to Mary, who knew nothing of her sister's allegation about the box. Mary tended, indeed, to dismiss the element of superstition in the accident. Alice has always considered herself too practical, she claimed. It was inevitable that she should someday have to recognize her limitations. Why, she could not even thinly slice a loaf of bread. To attempt to chop up hardwood was sheer folly. Miss Whittaker thought that she did not exaggerate, though, of course, it had not been Mary who had had to venture into the cellar, blood bespattered like a slaughterhouse, and retrieve the box to which Alice Norrington's fingers were adhering, glued into place by sticky, congealing blood. If it had been, Miss Whittaker thought, grimly, she could not have borne to restore the box to its accustomed place in the sitting room, where its incongruous presence was now emphasized by a gash from the axe along the edge of the lid. She wondered if Mary would be insensitive enough to leave the box there when her sister came out of hospital. She was rather afraid that she would. Her surprise and relief was therefore considerable when, returning from a visit to Alice one afternoon, she saw that the box had gone from the rosewood work table in the window. Before she could inquire the reason, Mrs. Forrest came in to say that Miss Mary was lying down in her room. "Is she worse?" Miss Whittaker demanded, fearing some fresh disaster. "The vicar called, and then she was took poorly. She said I was to ask you to go in." The vicar's visits were not usually distressing. Miss Whittaker hastened to ascertain the facts, tapping at the door of the bedroom, the former dining room since Mary was now unable to manage stairs. She found her sitting up in bed with the same tense and twitching anxiety that her injured sister habitually displayed. "What's the matter?" Miss Whittaker asked noncommittally. "I have had a very serious shock. It means that you are right about the box, Ellen. We must certainly dispose of it at once." Miss Whittaker wondered what the vicar could have had to do with this development. She was not left long in doubt. "We have been speaking of Alice's accident," Mary Norrington said faintly, "and I remembered what you said about the box, how it must have been stolen in the first place, because such objects have always been handed down. It occurred to me to ask the vicar if he had any idea how Stella had acquired it, and to my surprise, he had. He said she inherited from her father only 6 months before she died." "An old family treasure?" Miss Whittaker inquired softly, though the sinking of her heart already told her that this was not going to prove to be the case. "Not at all. The old man had bought it at an auction without even knowing what it was. He was something of an antique collector and had bid for a mahogany roll-top desk. When the desk was delivered, the box was discovered in a drawer. The auctioneer said he could reckon it as part of the lot. He had no interest in it and stored it away in an attic, where it was found only after his death, because he too died, Ellen, within a year of acquiring it. He caught pneumonia and it proved too much for his heart. So it begins to look as if you're right about the curse, doesn't it? Especially when I tell you this last bit. You remember I told you Stella's father bought the box accidentally at an auction? Well, do you know why that auction was taking place?" "I can guess," Miss Whittaker murmured sotto voce. Mary Norrington seemed not to hear. "The owner of the house had been killed in a car crash," she whispered. "His widow put everything up for sale. I don't know how long he'd had the box or who had it before him, but I am certain the box was to blame. So many deaths cannot be coincidence. I was foolish not to have believed you before. There is clearly something noxious about the object. I've had Mrs. Forrest put it in the garden shed." "That won't save you," Miss Whittaker said automatically. Mary Norrington gripped her arm. "Then what will? We cannot give it away because it will bring destruction upon others, and we know what happened when Alice tried to chop it up. Of course she is, as I say, rather clumsy, but I should not wish anyone else to try. How, then, are we to rid ourselves of this evil object, or must I, like its previous owners, die?" "We could burn it," Miss Whittaker said slowly. "Magic is supposed to have no power against fire."
"Like burning a witch in the old days?"
"Yes," Ellen Whittaker answered, "a little like that."
"And would you be prepared to burn it? Do you think it would be safe for you to try?"
Miss Whittaker looked thoughtful. "Yes, I think so. At any rate, I am prepared to make the attempt, only not in the house, in the garden. I will do it tomorrow, if it is fine." Mary Norrington relaxed against her pillows.
"Dear Ellen, what should I do without you? You are such a tower of strength, and I must believe your hair is looking better for that oil treatment. We must remember to try another one quite soon." Miss Whittaker was for once glad to take up the subject of her appearance in preference to the burning of the box. She was reluctant to admit to Mary Norrington that her knowledge of magic was greater than she had disclosed, for Ellen Whittaker was intellectually adventurous and by no means prepared to stop short at the limits of Christian belief when there was something outside it that seemed worth her exploration. In Nepal she had made friends with a magician, who besides much else had taught her a secret sign which would, he claimed, protect her from all danger should anyone ever lay a spell on her. Miss Whittaker had been suitably grateful, having witnessed Tibetan magic at work, but she had shortly afterwards been posted to Africa, and she had never needed to make use of the sign. She was relieved about this for several different reasons, not the least being that she felt it incompatible with her faith. To inquire into native magic was one thing, to resort to its rituals something else. For this reason, she had never mentioned her knowledge. In fact, she had half forgotten it herself, until the destruction of the Tibetan box became imperative and she realized that the task must fall to her, for she alone had the power to overcome its magic, provided she used the chosen agent, fire. The next day was fine and almost windless. Miss Whittaker resolved to have her bonfire after lunch. The morning was spent in preparation, for she was anxious that nothing should go wrong. She had amassed a pile of leaves and withered branches, chrysanthemum stalks and rotting flower heads, and to these she added firewood from the cellar, old newspapers, and a paraffin-impregnated briquette. The pyre was built by the angle of the wall, which at this point was bare fruit trees, so that no living thing should suffer any harm. Nevertheless, Miss Whittaker knew a certain uneasiness which common sense was unable to dispel. Perhaps it was this that made her place two buckets of water within easy reach of her prospective blaze. She was taking no chances with magic, and that included her own untried magic power. She was relieved when Mary Norrington announced that she would not be present at the incineration. She would not even watch from the sitting room. This meant that there would be no one to witness the operation, for the nearest house was some little distance away. Mrs. Forrest went home at 2:30. Whatever happened, there would be no one there to see. If it became necessary to resort to the use of magic, Miss Whittaker could do so in secret and alone. All the same, she sincerely hoped it would not be necessary, and took all scientific precautions first. In addition to the two buckets of water, she equipped herself with tongs and a rake. Stout oxfords and thick socks protected feet and ankles, and her hands were shielded by heavy gauntlet gloves. Her tweed skirt would have smothered fire sooner than kindle. The same went for her cardigan of Shetland wool. Her head was muffled in a scarf, tied turban fashion, not a single lock poked forth from underneath. Miss Whittaker was particularly careful with the turban, which was doing double duty that afternoon. Not only did it serve to protect her hair from ash fragments, but it also concealed its unappetizingly greasy state. Miss Whittaker, having submitted that morning to another of Mary Norrington's oil treatments, to be followed that evening by another special shampoo. But between the morning and the evening came the afternoon, and Mary had retired for her rest. Clutching the box to her like a living creature, Miss Whittaker made a conspiratorial exit from the garden shed. The sun was shining with almost the warmth of summer. She felt herself sweating under her woolen tweed. The thought of fire heat as well was intolerable. She had a sudden impulse to go back. The sharp contours of the box recalled her to a sense of duty. To leave it intact would mean that Mary Norrington must die, or if not Mary, some other innocent possessor. There was nothing for it. The box must be destroyed, and the burning of wood was an entirely natural process. There was no reason why she should feel this growing fear. Besides, if the worst happened and there was unnatural manifestations, she had only to make the sign. The magician had assured it was infallible. Whatsoever saw it must withdraw at once. She was probably the one person in England who could burn the box in safety. With trembling hands, she knelt and lighted the pyre. The paraffin briquette caught at once, and so did the paper. Then the sticks kindled into a lively blaze. The twigs caught, and some of the drier dead leaves crackled. The smell of autumn burning filled the air. The bonfire was built high in the center to support a level platform of sticks. Miss Whittaker approached and placed the Tibetan box upon it, then stepped backwards with a nervous little gasp. The fire continued to burn brightly with much crackling and showering of sparks.
Then as it spread to the damp leaves, stalks, and flower beds, it began to give off smoke. Miss Whittaker drew back, coughing. She had not supposed there would be so pungent a smell. The fire, too, was burning less brightly. The afternoon seemed suddenly overcast. Looking up, she was astonished to see the smoke reeling in dense black clouds overhead, forming a tented ceiling above her, shutting out the sky and the sun. Meanwhile, its columns continued to wreathe upwards with a curious serpentine twist, so black they appeared to have substance and to move in response to some directional control. The box had remained untouched in the center of the bonfire, which is subsiding now into ash. So far as Miss Whittaker could see, the flames had not even touched it. She poked nervously with a rake, causing the platform of sticks to collapse with a sputter, tilting the box on its side. The smoke was growing momentarily more acrid. It was becoming difficult to breathe. Miss Whittaker's eyes were watering. She clapped a handkerchief to her nose. No doubt it was blurred vision that made her perceive in the smoke coils a vaguely remembered design, the double curve folding back on itself with a foot uplifted. Was it not the dragon of the box? She wiped her eyes, blaming an overstrained nervous system, and looked again. But surely those were scales, black and sinuous and almost stationary. The dragon reared up from the pyre. The terrible four-clawed feet were extended, groping. The head in profile now moved slightly from side to side. Miss Whittaker could see clearly the protective frill surrounding jaw and throat. The mandarin whiskers, even longer and thinner than she remembered them, trailed off into a wisp of smoke. Now and again a puff exuded from the wide space, flaring nostrils. Each time the cavernous mouth opened, there was a rolling belch of smoke. The dragon seemed to be searching for something. Its body made sudden lurches in the air. It was, for all the world, as if it were playing blind man's buff with an imaginary opponent, who fortunately for him was never there. For there was no doubt of the dragon's hostile intentions. The groping claws were poised to seize and tear, and the size of the creature was such that a full-grown buffalo could have been dismembered as easily as a rat. Miss Whittaker watched in horrified fascination. She had never seen anything to equal this. This was Tibetan magic with a vengeance, which was what the dragon appeared to desire, and she herself was its immediate object. Instinctively, she drew a little further back. It was one thing to know the sign which would invalidate Tibetan magic, but quite another to have it into use. She flexed her fingers into the required position. At least she had not forgotten what to do. It was comforting to realize that she had power over this dragon, who looked so terrible in black. A twig snapped sharply behind her. As if it had heard, the dragon turned its head. The long neck undulated gently. At the other end of the beast, the barbed tail lashed. The smoke which composed the dragon had now completely blotted out the sky. The brightness of the flames had sunk to the dull glow of ashes. A wind seemed suddenly to have sprung up. It lifted the frill about the dragon's jawline. The mandarin whiskers streamed wide. The distended nostrils were quiver as the dragon sought to scent its prey. Suddenly, the head poised in its veering impregnations. Despite the smoke, it had caught Miss Whittaker's scent. With a tremendous writhe of its coils and convolutions, it reared up to its full height. The claws were fully extended. Some 4 feet above her, the bearded face looked down. It held an indescribable weight of menace. For all her confidence, Miss Whittaker began to be afraid. She raised her hand in the required ritual gesture and looked up to meet the dragon's gaze. It peered down at her, evil and impassive from the orbless sockets of its eyes. With a little scream, Miss Whittaker flung herself sideways as the dragon's claws lashed down. They missed her, but she felt the wind of their passing. The dragon reared itself again. Now that it seemed to have her scent in its nostrils, it proved impossible for her to evade. Whichever way she darted in the smoke pall, the blind monster's claws were just behind. There was a clatter as she knocked over the buckets. The water spread around her, soaking her socks and shoes. She was already exhausted and panting. The acrid fumes from the pyre were making her choke and cough. The house, the garden, seemed suddenly to have receded. There was only darkness and smoke. On the fire, which gave the dragon its being, the Tibetan box lay upended, still untouched. If only the flames would consume it, the dragon would surely cease to exist. Seizing the rake, Miss Whittaker made one last desperate assault upon it and thrust it into the heart of the fire, while the dragon reared itself above her, preparing to nail her to the ground. At the last moment, by a dexterous twist and feint, she escaped it.
A shower of sparks rained down. They smoldered for a moment on their heavily woolen garments. Gasping, Miss Whittaker beat them out. One corner the box had taken. The wood was beginning to char. The dragon, though still dangerous, appeared to be shrinking. The clouds of smoke were less voluminous, less dense. Yet the heat seemed all at once to have become quite insupportable. Miss Whittaker had a sudden glimpse of the sun. She saw the house, the garden, the chrysanthemums, and the apple trees, the peaceful normality of it all. Then, as an unquenched spark ignited her oil-soaked hair into combustion, she ran screaming towards the house. She did not see her bonfire fall apart and burn itself out in isolated patches. She did not see the Tibetan box roll free. She saw only the horrified face of Mary Norrington as she emerged from her room into the hall. "Mary, help me! Help me!" Miss Whittaker screamed in terror, endeavoring to beat out the flames. But Mary only stood white-faced and clutching the doorpost, unable either to move or speak. She saw before her Ellen Whittaker's body. On her head a strange corona of flame, the skin of the scalp already blackening and peeling, the face distorted beyond belief. The apparition from hell was advancing towards her. The Tibetan box's curse was coming true. With a cry, Mary Norrington doubled up in the doorway. She was dead before her body reached the ground. The double tragedy at Throstle Cottage, as the newspapers called it, did nothing to reassure Miss Alice Norrington as to the innocuous nature of the box. Nor did her convictions regarding this fire and axe-scarred object, and her insistence on returning it via the late Miss Whittaker's friend in India to Tibet, do anything to reassure her superiors at evangelical headquarters as to her suitability for return to the mission field. She was compulsorily retired from service, without too much protesting on her part, and now lives on the south coast near Worthing, and attends psychometry readings once a week.